When did you first realize you were black, or Latino, or Asian, or white? And what exactly was it you realized? It was more than a skin color, right? What did having a racial identity tell you about who you really are? I'm Brian Ellis, and today on Central Standard, we're reflecting on the tragedy in Charleston, the Confederate flag controversy, the questions over whether Rachel Dolezal was really black, and we're asking, what is racial identity anyway? How is it formed? And can you talk about a white racial identity in the same way you do for other backgrounds? We'll also talk with a local pastor about how what happened at Bible study in Charleston will affect his own community's welcome of the stranger. It's ahead on Central Standard after the news. The sound of Sunday's service at the Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church near 18th and Vine. Parishioners were responding to last week's murder of 9 people at an AME church in Charleston, South Carolina. The Reverend Robert Shaw said the tragedy wouldn't stop the church from welcoming both members and visitors.
We will still carry ourselves as believers of God to believe that this will not stop us. This won't stop us from loving and worshiping God. And this won't stop us from loving our brothers and sisters, regardless of race, color, creed, ideology, background, from demographics, wherever you come from. Guess what? We still love you.
The shooting left many of us with questions, and it hit particularly close to home for Bethel AME and for other African-American congregations in our community. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. Later this hour on Central Standard, we're going to talk about the formation of racial identity in this country. But first, the Reverend Robert Shaw, Bethel AME's pastor, is here with us. Reverend Shaw, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
It's really nice to have you here. And I know you were acquainted with at least Reverend Pinckney and maybe others, and I'm sorry for your loss and your community's loss.
Thank you. We appreciate the prayers and the condolences that have been shared with our church from all faith communities, and it's a testament that we're all in this together.
You know, we heard a little of your sermon, and I have to think it can't have been easy to preach a sermon about forgiveness and about kindness to the stranger just a few days after what happened in Charleston.
Yes. Ironically, this was our brother's weekend, a time that had been set aside to lift up the men in our church, and these plans had already been scheduled. But prior to that, on Friday, we were having a family night, and we took a moment of silence to acknowledge the loss. On Saturday, we had a men's prayer breakfast with a special guest speaker, the Reverend Warren Freeman from Willis Chapel AME Church. And then on Sunday, our guest speaker was Presiding Elder C. Jessel Strong from St. Louis, Missouri. But before service began, we wanted to take a moment of silence and then recognize the tragedy that had been taking place. And we read a litany that had been passed out throughout the denomination that was written by one of the bishops of our church, Bishop A.J. Richardson, who stated, "The doors of the church are open."
Hmm. How hard was that for members of your congregation to sort of call to mind those who had been killed, and to imagine, I would think, to imagine what if it were here? What would that be like?
Exactly. We had, on that Wednesday, we had just finished our own Bible study. Hmm. And then to know that as the AME Church, we are a family. It's considered the connectional church, whereas we have 20 regional, which would be considered Episcopal districts all across the world. Each of those districts are presided over by a bishop. For this area, our bishop is the Right Reverend T. Larry Kirkland. His headquarters is in Los Angeles, California, but it runs from the 14 states west of the Mississippi.
Okay.
So at various meetings, we have opportunity to see each other, mm-hmm. to say hello. So it is like family, even though we may not be in each other's presence all of the time. we are considered family.
And when you speak to your fellow ministers, I'm sure you've had many conversations in the last week. Is there fear? Is there worry about the future after an incident like this?
We would reference it by saying the doors of the church are open, our arms are open, our hearts are open, but at the same time, our eyes are open. Hmm. We will not neglect what has taken place in society, but at the same time, we will not let that stop us from continuing to carrying forth the message of our Lord and Savior, Jesus the Christ.
I'm curious, you know, you're obviously an African-American pastor of a primarily African-American congregation in Kansas City. Kansas City is a different place than Charleston. Or is it, I guess? Do you feel like you're serving in a different kind of environment? Could this happen here?
I would believe that it could happen anywhere. I do agree with you. Kansas City is different from Charleston. I did have the opportunity to visit that particular church, Mother Emmanuel. A good friend of mine from seminary's grandfather's funeral was at that church.
It's a pretty prominent church in the denomination.
It is a pretty prominent church in the denomination. This is Mother Emmanuel was the church of Denmark Vesey, who led a slave revolt in earlier times. This church had been burned down by Klansmen, and in that particular time, because of the laws during slavery, it was illegal for African Americans to come together to worship. So it's a very familiar and prominent church within our Zion. But I would say also for Kansas City, of which I was born and raised in Kansas City, is a bit different. Mm-hmm. It could happen anywhere.
How is Kansas City different?
Well, I would say demographics-wise, it is a predominantly white city with the demographics of African Americans and Hispanics and other minorities. Also, I would say it would be different because of the, I wouldn't say racial tone, but just the culture and activities of out west would be different from that of back east.
You know, I have to wonder, has anything like the beginning of this incident, a white visitor coming to the door of the church, someone you don't know, but who wants to just come and join with you for Bible study or something going on at the church, has that happened?
Yes, that has happened before. We've had guests from different races and different nationalities. And prior to this incident, it was open arms, open doors, come share with us. Here, if you did not have a Bible, we'd share a Bible with them. Mm-hmm. Ironically, after this happened at our prayer breakfast, one of your production assistants came to visit our prayer breakfast.
Yeah.
And a member walked up to him and said, may I help you? And what are you here for? And in light of what has taken place, that was an honest question, yeah. But it did not stop the fellowship. And Kyle was able to participate with all of the activities.
That's excellent. You know, you mentioned that the doors are open, but so are your eyes.
Correct.
What do you mean by that? Does that mean that you're paying more attention to security, to keeping an eye on who the strangers are who come to the door?
I wouldn't say just keeping our eyes open more on the strangers, but being aware of our surroundings. Prior to this incident at Bethel Church, our trustee board, which are responsible for the physical facility and maintenance facility of the church, we had discussion on a plan of action, fire drill, what if scenarios, and what would take place. We do have unarmed security, and our budget analysis also looked at armed security as well. But even in spite of, we have members within the congregation during service who literally have their cell phones in their hand ready to call the authorities in the case of a scenario that would take place that would call for the authorities.
Do you find it sad or unfortunate that you have to have those kinds of preparations?
I find it sad, yes, but it's also the real world in which we live in. Because unfortunately, as it has taken place at churches, synagogues, even right here in Kansas City, and mosques, this is the world that we live in. but we cannot be dictated by others' actions to continue to carry the message.
Before we let you go, we're talking today about the formation of racial identity, and we're talking about that on a broad scale. I'm curious, how much a part of forming Black identity is being part of a religious institution like your AME Church?
Correct. The AME Church was a church that was born out of protest. In Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in 1787, Richard Allen, our founder, Absalom Jones, and several others walked out of St. George Methodist Episcopal Church because of
a primarily white church,
correct, because of racial biasness and stereotypes and prejudiceness toward our people. Mm-hmm. During prayer, they were told to get up and go somewhere else. And our founder, Richard Allen, said, after we pray, we will leave you and be gone. We will be here no more. And out of that, our first church was in a blacksmith shop. The first pulpit was an anvil,
wow,
which stated that we will forge our own and set forth to worship God freely. Now, African recognizes our heritage, but it does not mean it's exclusive or only to persons of African descent. It's open to all races. It's open to all creeds. And out of that, Methodist was the method of theology of which we were forming within our denomination, and Episcopal recognizes the government within our denomination.
I have to wonder, I know that the African American church through a lot of the 20th century was the real incubator of leadership and I think of racial identity to a very significant degree. Do you feel like that's changing in today's world?
I do believe it's changing, for we recognize our heritage from which we have been birthed. But at the same time, we recognize and open up the door, because in God's family, regardless, red or yellow, black or white, they're all precious in His sight.
That's the Reverend Robert Shaw. He is pastor of Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Kansas City, Missouri, kind of in the 18th and Vine District. One more question for you, Reverend Shaw. As you think about next Sunday and the Sunday after that, how much will this... these incidents continue to be a part of your sermons? Is the congregation ready to move on, as quote unquote move on, or is this going to be something you're talking about for a long time?
Well, according to 1 Thessalonians 4:13, we sorrow not as those who have no hope. At the same time, we recognize what has taken place. Even in particular, the Emmanuel Nine, they did have names. And even on these instances, when we're on the radio, we'd like to recognize them and their family, Reverend Clemente Pinckney, Reverend Daniel Super Simmons, the Reverend Sharonda Coleman Singleton, Brother Tawanza Sanders, Sister DePayne Middleton Doctor, Sister Cynthia Hurd, Sister Myra Thompson, Sister Ethel Lance, and Sister Susie Jackson. We recognize them and continue to press forward, because we believe that's what they would want us to do.
Thank you for reading their names. Thank you for remembering them. And thank you for your work in Kansas City. That's Reverend Robert Shaw. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
When we come back, we'll broaden this conversation beyond Kansas City and Charleston to some of the other questions swirling in the news the last few weeks, from the head of Spokane, Washington's NAACP chapter, admitting she is white, to the intense debate about the Confederate flag. What is racial identity? Where does it come from? We'll talk about that when Central Standard returns on KCUR. Stay with us. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. We've all filled out forms that ask us to identify our race. For some, that's a pretty simple decision about which box to check. For others, it's more complicated. But figuring out what it means to check one or more of those boxes, what we think when we're saying I am black or white or Latino or Asian, may raise surprisingly complex questions for everyone. We're talking today about racial identity and how it is formed. And joining us now in the studio is Dr. Sean Alexander. He teaches in the African American Studies Department at KU. Welcome to you, Sean.
Thank you.
We're glad you're here. And also joining us is Dr. Susan Wilson. She's the Vice Chancellor for Diversity and Inclusion here at UMKC. She's also a contributor here at KCUR. Welcome back, Susan.
Well, thank you, Brian.
Good to see you. Sean, if I may begin with you, with what probably seems like a ridiculously basic question. There are African Americans in literature and history and science and sociology, and there are departments teaching all of those things elsewhere in the university. Why do people study, or why do you study, with a particular focus on a particular race?
Well, what I do is I teach African-American history, but at the same time, I would argue that I actually teach American history. The African-American experience is central to the understanding of America and the development of America and the creation of our nation from the founding all the way to the present. And as we see with current events, race stays central to that discussion. And so what I look at it as is that it's a topic that I chose to study and have developed. And what I've saw over the years is that it allows me to teach people more about the nation that they are part of, that they don't get in everyday textbooks and everyday life.
And Susan, you deal with issues of diversity and inclusion every day, but you're also a psychologist.
Yes.
And I wonder, how important have you found the formation of a person's racial identity to their overall identity? That is, to what degree does it matter what race one is or understands oneself to be to know who they are?
Well, you know, I would first say that the whole concept of race, even before identity, is a very complex one. That some people view it from a biological standpoint, and we're talking there about gene pools and physical characteristics, and it's been used in some racist ways to then talk about intelligence and character. So there's been a lot of controversy about biological definitions and whether from a DNA perspective that even holds true. But the other piece is social and cultural. And I think that identity in general is what forms the structure of our personality. In other words, if we didn't have an identity, we would kind of be sort of like a blob that didn't know which way it was going. And so identity is a good unifying and structuring factor. But more to your question, racial identity is important. Because when you are a person that looks a certain way, has brown skin or yellow skin, you are going to be looked upon differently. And part of the importance of identity formation is then how do you respond to a world that sees you as different?
Is it then primarily about because other people will receive you a certain way because of your race? Or is it also about how you think of yourself in and of yourself? Does that make sense?
Yes, I think it's both. It's how other people see you and how you see yourself, and the two interact constantly. Now, there's some interesting demographic trends that have made this even more of an issue, because multiracial groups, according to the U.S. Census, are increasing, which makes the issue of racial identity come to the forefront. And also in terms of African Americans, the fastest growing group are people who are from African descent and Caribbean descent. And so it's not only racial identity, it's also ethnic identity.
And the heritage that is felt by those communities is different than the descendants of slaves.
Very much so. Now, there are some theorists that talk about the development of racial identity, which I can also talk about.
Let's definitely talk about that. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about some of the different stories in the news this week that have brought a lot of the questions into focus over time. Let me ask both of you, though, about sort of your own coming into these issues. Susan, you identify as an African American.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean to you?
Well, it means to me, and again, identity is formed often by our surroundings and how we grow up and who our parents are. And so I grew up in predominantly African-American communities. I was shaped by the music, the culture, the art. My dad, who was very much a jazz aficionado, so all of that. And the relatives that I had most access to were African-American, because I'm also part Italian. But unfortunately, at a young age, because my mother married out of her race, she was disowned. So I never was around those relatives. Had I been more around the Italian side, maybe I would have identified more as biracial. Although back when I grew up, there wasn't such a thing as biracial. You were just a light-skinned African-American girl.
It feels like your mother being disowned by her family because of a decision to marry out of her race would be a very significant shaping experience for you in terms of your own racial identity.
Well, at that time, I didn't think much of it. I just figured, you know, my grandparents on the Italian side were elderly anyway, so by the time I was 8 years old, they had passed away, and I had some access to my grandmother and her sister. But I don't think you think much of it, because part of the issue of identity, it's formed by what are the most strongest influences around you. And again, you know, when I would go in the white world, nobody saw me as white, you know. Some people might mistake me for Hispanic or Puerto Rican or something like that, but nobody ever said to me, you're white. So...
Yeah, interesting. I know, if I can turn to you, Sean, you teach African American studies, because we're on the radio, you are white. Are people often surprised by that?
They are. I would say that it happens less today than it did 20 years ago. I've been doing this a very long time. In the early 90s, when the height of Afrocentricity, the Nation of Islam, and things like that, the surprise of a white professor behind the desk shocked many people. I would say that happens, again, less today than it does in the past. It has in the past, though I think there are some people that are still surprised by it. You know, you can go give a talk and you'll hear the people as you're walking through the audience saying, he's white, he's white. you know, all expecting that you are African-American because this is what you do. But I think the important thing to understand with that is that actually tells us how much race matters in American society. That we don't really look back and question, you know, to put a number on it would be difficult, but I would say over 90% of the time, you're not going to ask a white woman from Ohio, why does she teach Italian history or French literature? But you're always going to turn to a Caucasian male or female and say, why do you teach African American history? Why do you teach African American studies?
Well, is that different? Is it different for a white woman from Ohio to teach Italian history than for a white American to teach African American studies? Is there something different about what Italian history represents and what African American studies represent?
Technically, no. There is no difference. The difference is the value that we put on it and the way that we discuss race. I mean, race to talk about race in America and bring it down to the binary of black and white. We have a group of people who assume that whites and blacks are separate. And, you know, the only reason that you would study African-American history, myself as a Caucasian male, is that I've got something deep in my past that I must be hiding in my closet that tells me that I'm connected to the African-American community in some way, rather than just it's an interest.
Yeah. Why is it an interest? Where did that come from for you?
It's a pretty simple story. I mean, I grew up in a small town in Illinois, about 6,000 people, almost majority white. But I became interested in South Africa. I was a kid who watched the news all the time. And in the 80s, South Africa was on the news all the time. And I wanted to know more about South Africa and what was happening. And I always liked history. And so I began to read that information and was drawn towards African history rather than African American history. And when I went to college, I mean, not to draw out the story, but when I went to college, the man that was teaching me African history was also teaching me African American history. But he had spent the last 17 years in Botswana, so he was kind of relearning African American history. And in that process of talking about African American history, studying with him independently in his office, talking about books, etc., I slowly migrated towards the field of African American history rather than African history. But it really was just a direct interest and desire to understand. And as I began to study African American history more, you know, I began to see the centrality of race and African American life, history, culture to the American experience. And I wanted to learn more about that. And I wanted to bring that to students in the classroom as well as the general public.
You know, I've been reading in preparing for this show that there's actually a growing field of study in whiteness studies or white studies. Dozens of universities actually offering classes or programs in this. It sort of leads to the question whether there really is a white racial identity. Is that something different than talking about a black racial identity?
So actually, there's a theorist, a psychologist, Janet Helms, who developed a model of white identity. And I think also Peggy McIntosh has done a lot of work on white privilege and the fact that you have to understand your own culture and your own identity before you start understanding the differences that other people have. And a lot of white people, if you ask them, well, I don't really have a culture, but indeed there are elements of white culture that stand out to people who aren't in that culture.
So what are some of those elements? I mean, you mentioned privilege. Talk about that.
Well, I think that elements of white culture, I had a dear friend and colleague, Edward Nichols, and he talks about values differences between cultures. And he talks about European culture being very focused on time, precise time, on counting and measuring, on individualism and, you know, an individual family versus people of color are more extended family, more imprecise about time. And this is what he noticed after doing a number of comparative cultural reviews. And so,
sorry.
And so I think those are some of the elements that you would see. But as any group, there's no monolithic white culture.
I think you also have to be careful with that, because the whiteness studies has been around for actually a long time. In fact, one of the if you want to call a founders or one of the first scholars of whiteness in America is a new professor at KU, David Roediger. But the development of the field of whiteness in some of the fields, some of the discussions, you have to see what the individuals are doing. Some people are doing it with a discussion of understanding white privilege, and some people are doing it in a reaction to belief that white culture, white history is being attacked by America. And so there's element of whiteness studies that's anti-black at the same time as there's an element of understanding multiculturalism.
Which is sort of the next step beyond that way of talking about whiteness studies is white pride or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So then to come back to sort of to where we started, we asked about some of the elements of white culture or white whiteness. What does it mean then to be black? That's been very much in the news, and we'll talk more about that. But from Rachel Dolezal in Spokane to what was being said after the Charleston shootings, what are the central elements of black racial identity in America today?
Well, I think that again, I talked about white culture being focused on individualism and the achievement of an objective. And you contrast that to African-American culture. The highest value in many African-American cultures is people. So it's people's relationship with each other, extended families instead of just individual nuclear families. On, pageantry, symbolism, the importance of rhythm, and not only just in music, but in time. Mm. And I think the whole focus on the whole rather than the parts. Now, those are some kind of abstract ways of thinking about it. But you do see that in African-American culture today in terms of how cultural expressions take place.
I think at the same time, again, we have to be a little careful of that, because if we begin to say, have a checklist of cultural traits, then we're looking at something as being essentialist. And we have to be careful about claiming that something is essentialist and that we have, because it brings us closer to understanding that race is biological, and therefore we can go down that slippery slope that Susan started with, that it can be turned into a discussion of problematic
aspects. And can turn into unreasonable stereotyping, because there's no monolithic group of anyone.
Well, that's an important piece of this conversation. We're going to continue it after the break. When we return on Central Standard, we'll look at the critical identity formation years of high school, and we'll talk to one local teacher who worked with a small percentage of black students at his mostly white school to reflect and respond on who they were in light of a racist incident. We'll also explore some of those other stories in the news. Stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison. This is Central Standard. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. We're talking today about racial identity and how it gets formed. Sean Alexander of KU's African American Studies Department is here. So is Susan Wilson, who leads diversity efforts here at UMKC. But we want to turn now to a very practical example of all this, a place where users of social media, at least, could see racial identity being formed before their very eyes among high school students using Instagram. Joining us is David Muhammad. He's a teacher at Shawnee Mission East High School. Mr. Muhammad, welcome to the program. We do not have Mr. Muhammad on the line. We're going to try again. Are you there, David? Well, we will come back to David Muhammad, a teacher at Shawnee Mission East. To our listeners, we'd love to have your thoughts on the formation of racial identity. How have you come to understand who you are, racially speaking? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also write to us via Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Let me come back to our guests, Sean Alexander from KU and Susan Wilson from UMKC. We were talking before the break about what it means to be black and how we sometimes need to be careful about creating a list that might give way to stereotypes. I wonder, how do you find racial identity to be different than other aspects of a person's identity? So you were mentioning, Susan, earlier that there's sort of a distinction to be made between genetic or DNA sorts of elements versus cultural and social elements of identity. How is race different than something like gender or sexual orientation or nationality or political preference?
Well, I think that race, again, is an organizing principle, and there are theories that talk about, and as I mentioned, I think racial identity is shaped by the environment. And so, for example, if you are an African-American person that grows up in a white environment and then identifies with white culture, there are theorists who say that in a way, that doesn't prepare you to adapt to the world. And that's what identity does. Mm. It helps you adapt to the world around you. And so then something happens to that individual. They have an incident that happens that pushes them into a state of questioning. And then because they thought everything about white culture was right and everything about black culture was wrong. Right. And then it pushes them into another stage. Sometimes it's that stage of ethnocentricity. So now everything black is good, everything white is bad. And you see this in the 60s with a very militant kind of identity formation. And then something will happen again and they figure out, well, that's not true. There are bad black people too. And then the end of this cultural identity evolution is multiculturalism, where you embrace and love your own identity, but you also appreciate the cultures of others.
I think we now have David Muhammad from Shawnee Mission East High School with us. David, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Well, I'm very glad. Apologize for the technical difficulty there. I wonder if you could take us back to earlier this spring and to the incident that got this particular conversation started at Shawnee Mission East. What happened?
I teach at Shawnee Mission East, which is a predominantly white school. We have about 0.8% black students, so about 28 black students in the entire school.
Out of and, 1,600 or something?
Yeah, a little bit over 1,600. Okay. So, definitely the minority group. And I've been meeting with some of the black students and just discussing different stereotypes and such. And we came across an anonymous Instagram account, which was said some very harsh things that were racially motivated, and I won't repeat those things, but I took a screenshot of it and made it my Instagram for that day, and that kind of provoked myself and the students to do somewhat of a PSA, a public service announcement. So we decided after a lot of back and forth to do an Instagram post ourselves. So I mimicked it after the I2M Harvard campaign, and we called it I2M East. And the kids took whiteboards and wrote down different stereotypes and things that had been said to them, and we posted all the Instagram photos and used it as a way to get out awareness without being inflammatory.
Yeah, the I2M Harvard campaign you mentioned was at Harvard Law School, where African-American students were saying that they were posting statements of the ways they were being treated differently, and you applied that into the high school environment.
Yes, sir.
So I'm curious what that experience was like. How important was it for the African-American students who participated to be able to make that public statement about race?
Well, I think, first of all, I have to commend them, because high school is a very scary time. It's an interesting time. Everybody wants to fit in, you know, and especially at a school like that where you stand out so much. And a lot of those kids grew up in that environment. They've already formed by that point their identity groups and their friend groups. So for them to step out and say something like that and really voice their opinions, it took a lot of courage on their end. So I commend them. And I think it emboldened them, because I could tell afterwards they were like, what are we going to do next? You know, and or they come to me and say, you know, well, somebody did this. And in some cases, I had to kind of calm them down and make sure we didn't come across like we were trying to start a crusade. But you could see it gave them a lot more confidence in their own identity.
Talking with David Muhammad, he's a teacher at Shawnee Mission East High School, and invite our listeners to the conversation. How have you come to understand who you are, racially speaking? What are your thoughts on the formation of racial identity? Call us at 816-235-2888, 235-2888. You can also write to us on Twitter at KCURCST. David Muhammad, I'm curious about the reactions of white students who, as you said, make up the vast majority there at Shawnee Mission East. What was their response to this campaign?
You had a mixed bag. I would say most of it was positive. We got a lot of positive responses on the Instagram, and kids coming up to myself and the students who participated saying, you know, that was really cool and that's what we needed, as well as some of their parents and people in the community. But you also had people who felt like it made them uncomfortable, you know, because you were bringing up something that a lot of people don't feel comfortable talking about. Race is that thing that it's kind of like the elephant in the room, you know, and for especially that environment, race isn't something that people discuss. It's considered somewhat taboo. So there were some kids who came out and said, you know, are you trying to make East look racist? Are you trying to make us look bad? So, but at the same time, I think that that's a positive as well, because it gets them thinking, it gets them talking. So overall, it was a positive experience.
Could you share a few examples of what some of the students wrote in those posts on Instagram?
Yeah, sure. One of my favorites was a girl who is biracial. She said that when you say you don't see race, does that mean you don't see me? And then another girl said, somebody had told her, well, since you're half black, you should only be half offended by remarks that were said. You know, things like that. So those are some of my favorite one. I posted, I crossed out the N-I-G-G-E-R, N-I-G-G-A, and put neither, because we have some students at our school, both black and white, who use the N-word. And they'll say, well, I used this spelling, so it's okay. Or my black friend told me that I could use it. And so I just made a point of saying it was neither.
Yeah. I want to invite you to be part of the rest of this conversation, too. But one more question for you, David. You are, in addition to working with students who make up just less than 1% of the population at Shawnee Mission East, I know you're one of only a handful of African-American teachers there, too.
Yes.
What do you think went into your own identity formation? How did you come to understand yourself as an African-American?
Well, it's definitely been a process, and I think it's a process that I'm still undergoing because of things that go on in society. But I'm originally from Kansas City, Missouri, and around third grade, my parents, who are both African-American, moved us to Overland Park for the school district, where I was one of only a handful of African-Americans. We were actually like the first black family in the elementary school that I attended. So I grew up kind of doing what I call straddling the fence or code switching, you know, especially when I got to middle school, high school, and I was finally around a few more African-Americans. I wanted to fit in, you know, but at the same time, on the other end, I listen to Green Day and I play the violin, and you know, I knew that other side. So it was difficult as a youngster because you want to fit in with your people per se, but at the same time, I knew that I had a variety of things about me that some blacks would say was acting white. So it wasn't really till I got to college that I started to embrace the fact, much like Miss Wilson said, of this multiculturalism, you know, this idea that I'm comfortable as an African-American. I know what I am. I know what society sees me as, but I also can embrace other cultures and not feel like I'm selling out or not being myself. So it's something that I've constantly evolved with and I'm constantly evolving to do. And hopefully I can help others in that process as well.
816-235-2888 is the number to call if you want to share your seminal moments or important people or certain images or words that have shaped you and your racial identity. How did you come to understand that aspect of who you are? Give us a call, 816-235-2888. That's what Elizabeth did in Prairie Village. Elizabeth, welcome to Central Standard.
Thanks so much. I just wanted to...
No, go ahead. What's your question or comment?
Well, I just wanted to add, I'm actually a Tony McKinney graduate, and I'm white, and it wasn't until I really went away from East and started reading a lot more about race that I came to understand. I feel like this conversation, not just here in Prairie Village, but all over the nation, is really focused on defining race in terms of people of color, and I feel like a huge part of the conversation that's missing is what that implies for white people and all of the privilege that goes along with that. And the reason that you don't see race is because it doesn't work against you, and you enjoy a lot of privilege that you can't see. And I don't think that there's a lot of language out there for white kids for understanding what it means to be white or white adults. And I just think that, you know, getting past the race conversation, or not past it, but having that conversation, it's important for people who are white to start understanding what that conversation implies for them, even though it's not always verbalized.
Elizabeth, thanks so much for your call.
Absolutely.
Elizabeth mentioned the importance of talking about white privilege. David mentioned this term code switching. Sean Alexander from KU, can you talk a little bit about that? What is that about?
Well, first, I'd like to go back to the privilege point. And I think that that's really what's sparked your conversation is Rachel Dalzell a couple of weeks ago. And
right.
I think the understanding of privilege needs to come directly towards that. The fact that she can even choose that she wants to be black.
Now, just to review for listeners, Rachel Dalzell, she was the president of NAACP in Spokane, Washington. Her parents came forward a few weeks ago and told the world that she's not black, that she's white, that she's genetically white from them, and she eventually resigned as president of the NAACP.
And I think that it's important to understand the privilege that she has. Even people who are passing in the African American community into the white community, there's not the same privilege that's involved in that situation. There's a loss of contact, oftentimes. Disconnecting from the old community and things like that. Even Susan's mother crossing the color line and marrying into an African-American family is disconnected from her society. It's a very different thing that occurred, I think, in understanding that privilege. So
yeah, go ahead, Susan.
You mentioned code switching, and I would just like to say that's something that everyone who's African-American or probably another minority group learns to do when they're very young. It's how you speak on the phone to the insurance man versus who happens to be white versus your friends. I mean, I heard all of my aunts and uncles do that they had two different vernaculars, and I was bilingual too. I mean, I spoke the vernacular of the community, and I remember it took me about a year in college to be able to speak up in class because I was self-conscious about a different language I was speaking, but we still do it today. We tend to have to portray a different self when we're at work sometimes than when we're at home. But some of us who have been doing this for years figure out how to do it in a way that does not compromise our identity.
And white people don't have to code switch or don't even know what that is.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
Because they can bring themselves everywhere.
Yeah. David Muhammad?
Yeah, I was going to interject and say, you know, that's the thing. And I think that, you know, it's important to recognize how it's somewhat necessary for us to code switch. I know in my profession, I would be considered, not as academic if I spoke with the vernacular of much of the Black community in certain instances. And in other instances, too, you see African-Americans who give the Black vernacular to their white friends to allow their white friends a feeling of fitting in to Black culture. So it's like a show almost. So depending on the environment in which you're in, sometimes you code switch to please, and sometimes you code switch to entertain. And you have to ask yourself, well, why am I doing this? And is it really necessary at times?
Sherry is joining us from Leawood. Sherry, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, I wanted to ask the panel if they had seen a program on cable TV that came on about 8 years ago called Black/White. In it, there were two families, an African-American family and a white family that had their own assumptions and about their identities and the other group's identity. And with the help of professional makeup artists, they were able to transform themselves into looking like part of the other group, and for a number of weeks went into the other group's community and lived as the other group. However, the show really explored what is race beyond what you look at, kind of the baggage and the attitudes that you carry along inside of you. I'm just wondering if the panel has seen that program, if they'd like to comment on that. I thought it was really interesting, and it opened up a lot of discussion. It was actually quite painful to watch at times.
I do remember that. Thanks, Sherry, for the call. That program or others like it where individuals have immersed themselves in another community.
Susan? Well, I did not see that specific program, but there have been other attempts to, going back to the book Black Like Me, mm-hmm. and books like that where people made themselves look white or black, black in the case of Black Like Me, and what the learnings were about what it really was like to be black are very eye-opening.
Let's talk to Kathy in Odessa. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. I wanted to share my experience as a young 12, 13-year-old girl who lived in Montana. And back then, we had called only black people were called colored. And I'd seen two in my life sitting in the back of a bus. And I kind of stared, and my mother, corrected me and told me not to stare. And then we moved to St. Paul, Minnesota, and I was attending an inner-city school. They were 40%, I can't remember if it was white or black, but I took a different path to pick up my little brother at his daycare. Going home one day, I walked down a different street than usual, and there was a crowd of young people. They were all black behind me, and so they were joking and shoving each other and talking, and one of the girls came up and started talking to me and asked me if I was for integration or segregation. Now, this is in the early 1960s. This was before the I Have a Dream speech. And so, I said, I'm not sure exactly what those words mean, but I do
believe
that.
Kathy, go ahead. I need you to wrap up. We've got a bunch of calls.
Well, anyway, it turned out the reality of it was that I explained my Christian viewpoint and everything was fine and I was not harmed. And I learned to not crosstalk, but I learned to respect everyone from my Christian viewpoint. So color didn't make a difference. I have black and white nephews, and I'm very much in favor of peace.
Thanks, Kathy.
Bye.
I apologize for cutting you off. We're running a little short on time. I do want to give the guests a chance to respond to that. Kathy, as a white person, felt like she was able to explain her views, and that made everything better. How do you react to that?
Well, I think part of that encounter said to me is that when sometimes whites encounter blacks, there's a fear factor. That the concern is I'm going to be harmed in this scenario and I've got to talk fast and say something. And a lot of times you find that that's just not the case. If you have dialogue, that can really make a difference.
Go ahead, David.
I was going to interject. I think, if you Tanner Colby brings it up in his book, Some of My Best Friends Are Black. The idea that we just need to have the conversation, sometimes getting past that awkward phase and allowing things, making people uncomfortable, being comfortable making people uncomfortable, will kind of, once you get through that, then you can have a discussion and move forward. So I think it's very necessary, and we can't be afraid to let go through that awkward moment.
But I think that's I mean, I completely agree, and I like Kobe's book, and I mean, I agree with what Susan's saying. But as a nation, we continue to hedge at having that conversation. And I think we need to understand that right now we're in a unique moment where we've got this momentum, and it seems like a discussion is on the table. We've got, you know, Dalzell, we've got the tragic events in Charleston, we've got the president coming out and saying that we have to talk about race, and doing it in a way that everyone's focusing on the fact that he used a word, and not saying that what you're trying to tell us is that race doesn't exist, but just because you don't use a word does not mean that race does not exist.
And part of it is tolerating the discomfort in talking about it to have the conversation.
Exactly. And on that note, we should be beginning a second hour of the program, but instead we're wrapping it up. I want to thank Dr. Susan Wilson from UMKC, Dr. Sean Alexander from KU, and Mr. David Muhammad, teacher at Shawnee Mission East. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can listen back to this conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Kansas City, of course, is known to be a friendly, nice town, but does our niceness sometimes get in the way of ourselves? You can join us for that discussion tomorrow. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. We had help today from Cody Newell and Kyle Palmer. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date, coming up next.